usually you do another one called a Daihin Shinrani, which we don't do here because it's in Japanese. And then you chant the precepts, which we have chanted here, those precepts. Kind of send them off. And in the Buddhist tradition, usually the body, depending on the family, you know, if it's really a family where everybody practices, often the body will lay in state for like 3 days. You got to keep the room cool, and some of you got to pack the body with ice. And so everybody gets a chance to go in and just kind of hang out, and you can see how things change if you've ever been around a body that's, you know, an hour old, 2 hours old. You can feel the life force. And after 3 days of kind of hanging out, they're ready to go and you're ready to let them go rather than, you know, somebody coming in and zipping them in a bag after an hour and off they go and it's just too abrupt. And also in Buddhism, just because your heart and your breathing stop doesn't mean that your consciousness, you can still feel the life force in somebody's body for quite a while. So I wanted to just tell you that. So chant the Heart Sutra, and then we 108 times, like the number of beads on the mala, right? In both the Indian and Buddhist tradition. Gati, gati, paragati, parsabgati, bodhisattva. So the Heart Sutra is important because it actually, and I'm spending some time because to really understand, especially sort of the non-dualistic approach of the way Zen presents in terms of koan practice, or a lot of the way teachers are talking, it's almost impossible to kind of understand this concept of sort of non-dual reality unless you understand, spend some little time with the Heart Sutra. So, by way of review, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva that hears the cries of the world, is giving this. Buddha says, please give this Dharma talk because I want people to understand how to love. So Avalokiteshvara, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, the Prajnaparamita means practicing what we call emptiness, practicing to really try to understand non-intellectually a feeling of the integration of everything. That's what practicing Prajnaparamita means. It also means to do what you do. You sit here with your mind, it seems often very confused, and you sit in the middle of that and you learn how the mind functions and the body functions. So clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. So that first line pretty much says the whole Heart Sutra. It says, in early Buddhism, we saw that you aren't just this solid, concretized conception of yourself. You are, in fact, a stream of consciousness. That's what the skandhas are. That's what the aggregates are. Remember, we talked about it. Form, feeling, perceptions, impulses. But what's happening now is after 600 years of meditation, Buddhism is beginning to progress. It's a little bit like, as I said, the Old Testament progressing into the New Testament. We're going from the Old Testament of looking at things in a certain way, a little more punitive and authoritarian. We're moving more into love. And that's one way you could think about emptiness as sort of big love. Everything supporting everything else. You don't have to pull anything out. You don't have to put in yourself. You don't have to pull anything out. Before, the way the practice was more like you pay attention to the dharmas. Like, oh, there's an anger dharma. There is, an uptight dharma. There's a jealousy dharma. Those states of mind, and I've got to get rid of those dharmas. That's fine. That's part of the practice, and always will be. You know, anger comes up. Am I going to follow it? Am I going to feed it? Or am I going to just try to let it go? So we still do that work. But what's happening now after 600 years, they're adding a little different dimension, actually a big dimension, to meditation practice. It's more a sense of even if anger arises, see the emptiness of that anger. See that it's just ephemeral. You don't have to let it grab you. You don't have to identify around that. In your meditation practice, you can let it go. So when the student goes to Sejo and he says, how do you free yourself from encumbrances? And he says, who is encumbering you? Or you could say, what is encumbering you? I look at that koan two ways. One way I look at it is, what is encumbering you? You can sit in your meditation practice, and this is the main practice that you would find in Thailand and Burma and Sri Lanka. What are those states of mind that encumber you? That's one way to look at that. The other way to look at it is, who is encumbering you? There is no who that's encumbering you. You can just, any state of mind that comes is ephemeral and is basically empty. It's going to pass. Just don't get all uptight about it. That's a very different shift. You know, one shift is more like, I'm pretty flawed and I've got to root out this stuff. A little more old school, which we all need to do. But the new one has a more lighter feeling to it. It's more like it begins to introduce the concept of your basic goodness or your basic unconditioned mind. And you're relating to that kind of background of who you are, of wholeness, of goodness, of who you are. As Trungpa would say, it's your basic goodness, this unconditioned nature, your Buddha nature. You're identifying more with that, and these other states kind of flow through. Can you see a little bit different? It's really a big difference in terms of how you accept yourself and how you accept others. Instead of going around and saying, boy, if you've got a lot of hindrances, you know, this person really needs to straighten up. You go at it like, no, basically they're Buddha, and they, you know, occasionally they have these things that flow through. That's a very different way than how you relate to yourself and other people. And the Heart Sutra is trying to move you more in that direction. So Shariputra, who is the person that really understood all the different fields of dharmas, the list. Remember last week we talked about the Yogacara 100 dharma lists. So he really had these lists down, kind of like a lawyer. So he says, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself form. So that's pretty radical. I mean, remember I was saying how radical this is? It basically takes every substantial teaching that Buddhism had up to this point. You know, well, the skandhas are actually kind of solid. They're things, we're not solid, but the skandhas are, no, skandhas are, they're just empty. You can't hang on to them either. Then it says here, form is emptiness. Before it was like, as you said a minute with the dharmas, there's conditioned and unconditioned dharmas. Conditioned dharmas are the ones like greed, hate, delusion, and we transform those into the unconditioned dharmas, which are nirvana. Conditioned to unconditioned. What this is saying is, no. Nirvana and samsara, the world, are the same. They mixed up. You merge them together. One can't exist without the other. That's a very radical statement. Remember, I was saying, it's kind of like in Christianity, you would say, well, there's heaven and hell. We're going to just eliminate that concept. That would be pretty hard for a lot of Christians to go that way. And that's what it's basically saying is, here on earth, right here, is where you practice your salvation. Form is emptiness. And then it goes on and it says, Shariputra, form does not differ. Okay. Form itself is emptiness. And then it says, sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. That's exactly what they said in the first line. First line said the aggregates are empty. Those are the aggregates. Those are the skandhas. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. I, and they're going to say it again in a few minutes. I makes contact. eye makes contact, and then a feeling arises, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Those are all can be dharmas, and then they formulate into kind of a strong like or dislike, the samskaras. That's the way people practice. Now, what this is trying to introduce you to is those things are all flowing together. They're all, you can't separate them out the way it was done before. They're all empty. You can let them all go. They're self-liberating in some ways. So then he says, Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled or pure. So that's very radical again. What he's saying is these dharmas, remember the wholesome dharmas and the unwholesome dharmas? Greed, hate, delusion, spaciousness, emptiness, nirvana. That's on the other side. And you're moving from conditioned to unconditioned. It just says right here, they're neither defiled nor pure. They're neither defiled, meaning conditioned, or pure, unconditioned. He just eliminated that. I mean, I can imagine after 700 years, people that have been practicing this, just how radical that particular sentence would be. So, maybe, let's see, I had a few things I wanted to, comments I wanted to say at this point. So, what we're saying here is that the world is beyond so it's saying not only is the self, the skandhas, not what we think it is. Not only is the self not permanent, like that's where the doctrine of no self comes from. Not only is it permanent, but even the skandhas that make it up, you have to go even beyond that. And it's also saying that the world of nirvana is not different than the world we exist in. But what's most important is, what the Heart Sutra is saying, and this is kind of one of the pivotal teachings in the Heart Sutra, is that whatever we conceptually project out is by nature always somewhat wrong or wrong. Because any conceptualization is always a fixed entity, and nothing is a fixed entity. Everything is dependent on everything else. Nothing is fixed. So once you get that in, there's no need to hang on or be attached to any point of view. So there's two ways to approach the Heart Sutra, and different teachers approach it different ways. Thich Nhat Hanh tends to approach it like interdependence. I'm you and you're me. I'm the floor is me. Because I'm everything else, can we have a sense of warmth and connectivity to everything? That's where compassion comes from. That's why Avalokiteshvara is teaching this, is to show you that because you are everything, because you're practicing prajna, it just naturally a sense of caring and love flow forth from it. And he kind of stays there, because that's actually easier for us to understand. But a deeper significance of the Heart Sutra is that any point of view you have is limited. Now think about that. If that was really true, what divides you from other people? Usually your point of view, right? What keeps you from connecting with the person next door, across from you on your cushion? You're just a little different. You know, they look different, or they're in a different political party. It's your view and their view. So what the Heart Sutra is saying is any view you have is limited. So in the heart, as we've said, in the class that we're studying on Wednesday night, Suki Roshi's book of lectures says, not always so. You don't really understand what that means unless you study the Heart Sutra. That's what it means. It means whatever you want to say about anything is limited. So that should instill a tremendous sense of confidence. I mean, humility. A tremendous sense of humility. So when you're meeting with somebody, it's not like I'm right and let's argue about who's right or wrong. It's more like, well, here's a point of view. What's your point of view? You know, kind of like if you studied Marshall McLuhan's Nonviolent Communication. I just reread the book. kind of based on that a little bit. Like, well, I have to know what my reality is, but I want to know what your reality is. So like my Zumi Roshi used to say when a person made a strong position, he said, well, that could be true. That could be true. You know, it's not kind of the way I see it right now, but it could be true. That's very different than like, no, that's wrong. You know? So if we went around more with that point of view, it'd be a lot easier for the Israelis and Palestinians, you know, and the North Koreans and the South Koreans, and the Republicans and the Democrats could talk to one another. If you came at it more from this point of view, that whatever your point of view. So I like Norman's way that he looks at this, which is, it's okay to have an opinion and a point of view, you know, that maybe broccoli's better than, you know, a quart of ice cream for dinner at night, right? It's important to have those points of view, but try to hold them more with a sense of humor and flexibility. That's the operative modality. A little more humor and a little more flexibility in terms of what you think are so sacred. Open to other possibilities. That's what this is trying to encourage you. So in other words, rightness and wrongness are empty of any fundamental reality, because everything, every concept is empty. Everything is basically fluid and interdependent. It's all mixed up. Now, at this point, Kanze says, who's, you know, a Western-trained philosopher, he says, this is pretty far out. I know you may have trouble with this, and I understand that. I have trouble going. It's kind of like taking Aristotelian logic, you know, where it says, if you're A, you can't be B, right? If you're A, you can't be B. What this is saying is, no, A can be A, but it can also be B. I can be me, but I also can be you. That's what the Heart Sutra is saying. It's a very different way, always a different way to look at things. Let's see, what else did I want to say here? So, from this sentence here, where it says, Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled or pure, neither increase or decrease. Now he's going to revisit that in a minute, where he says, no old age and death and no extinction of it. And Thich Nhat Hanh does a really nice job in his book, which I really recommend you read. It's much easier than what I'm presenting, I think. You know, he's just a great teacher. He just says, well, when you think of birth and death, you know, think of it as like compost. You know, you're going to end this particular incarnation or physical or mental presentation is going to evolve into something else. You know, so in other words, birth just doesn't happen independently. It comes out of causes and conditions, right? So that's why there's a continuum. So you don't think, the way we normally think is like birth, death. But now we're looking at it like birth, death. You can see where the concept of reincarnation comes from. Which you can either believe some consciousness gets to reincarnate in a physical form, or you can just believe that nothing ends. It just takes another form. You can have a choice there, which I'll get to in a minute when we talk about the 12-fold chain of dependent origination. So we also have to be careful here, because we don't want to concretize the word empty. We don't want to make, like, everything else is this way, but emptiness is the thing that we really have to worship. So even emptiness is just a point of view. You have to let go of emptiness, too. You can't hang on to it. The only reason we like to use emptiness is it's just a kind of provisional word we use to kind of try to move you to a bigger way of looking at things. It's kind of a, we'd say, as one teacher said, kind of a provocative word that kind of gets you to, oh, emptiness. What does that actually mean? But the point of view of emptiness, as I've said, is that it destroys all views. And so it even destroys itself. Do you understand what I'm saying? You can't even hang on to, you know, the concept of emptiness. So, let's see. So maybe the next thing would be, so what they're saying here is defiled or pure. So therefore, given emptiness, there's no form, no sensations, no perceptions, no formations, no consciousness. Again, they're just saying this, the aggregates, the skandhas that they mention, the way we perceive the universe is all together, all mixed up. And then it says here, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness. So what that means is they're just, because clearly there are, right? But what they're saying, and this is kind of an important point, is there's an I, right? There's an I, and then the I makes a contact. So I and sight, and then consciousness develops around that, and some scars develop around that. That's how you formulate how you perceive things in the world. So what they're saying is, if they're not saying there's no I, what they're saying is that the I and what the I makes contact with, or the ear, or taste, or touch, or thought, those six things make contact, and then consciousness happens. But you can't divide them up. You can't say there's just no I without the contact or without the consciousness, that they're all connected. But the implication of that is, we think that we're here and we think the world is out there. We think we're here and the tree is out there. What this is saying is that there's no inside or outside. The tree and you are basically all together. You can't separate out your consciousness from what's happening out there. So that has a very substantial impact, because what we do is we want to put the problem out there. Or we want to put, that is different than what we have in here. What this is saying is, no, it's all wrapped up into one. In fact, the Yogacara takes it even further. They say, you know, you can't even say that the material world exists, you know, separately from our consciousness. So it puts the responsibility on you in some ways, you know, partially on you, because you see that you're creating your world. Your consciousness is creating the world. And you begin to see that, rather than that out there is creating my consciousness. See the difference? There's a real difference. In the Lojong slogans, there's one real zinger of a slogan that says, drive all blames into one. So on one hand, it just means take responsibility for your own state of mind. Even if something out there is bothering you, how you respond to it is you. But on a deeper level, it means you're co-creating this process all the time, the world and you. So those are called the 18 dhatus, because you have the eye, and then you have contact, and then you have consciousness. And it's just basically saying it's all together. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind. And then it says that we have about 12 there. Then we have no realm of sight, and then they skip, and they say no realm of mind consciousness. So they're just trying to abbreviate, which they do a little bit later. They try to abbreviate. They don't go through every, you know, sight, consciousness, hearing, consciousness. They're just skipping. They're making it a little easier here. They're trying to abbreviate the form here. Then it says, there's neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death nor extinction of old age and death. Okay, so what they just did there is they just eliminated the 12-fold chain of codependent origination. What they're saying is, in the past, which I'll explain in a minute, this is how karma operates. This is how things change through causality. One thing causes the next. What they're pointing out here is that, yeah, but don't divide them up. This may be good provisionally, but it's all together. Even these little divisions, which early Buddhism thought was important, they're all just views. They're all empty. You know, begin to see that. Don't try to hang on to them. And then it says, no suffering, no cause, no sensation, no path, no knowledge, and no attainment. Well, that's really radical. They just took the Four Noble Truths of Buddha. Suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's elimination of suffering, and there's the Eightfold Path. They just said here, there's no suffering, no cause, no sensation, no path, and no knowledge. So they don't want you to hang on to anything. They don't even want you to hang on to sort of the seminal teachings of Buddha. They want you to see that even these things, that suffering comes from no suffering, right? It's taking it to a very different level. There's nothing you can hang on to. There's nothing like some dogma that you need to defend, like so many religions, right? There's dogma. Here it is. And you can't even defend emptiness, you know? So that's why this is so radical, you know? So I thought maybe I would just take a minute, because this is kind of interesting. And, yeah. Well, can you have no suffering without suffering? That's one way to look at it. Could you have suffering without no suffering? Could you have good without evil? So it's just, one is kind of dependent on the other, on a very high level. This is taking you into kind of more the realm of the absolute, you know. On the realm of the relative, yeah, there is suffering, and you need to address it. You need to hear those specific cries of suffering. So that's the trick, is to hold. Remember last week I was saying you have to hold both. You have to hold wisdom, which gives you the big picture, that it's all one. And then you have to hold compassion, which is how to address suffering. If you have too much compassion, and all you see is suffering, you burn out, or you can burn out. If you have too much wisdom, and you take it too much to the big picture, you're too aloof, you're too detached, you don't feel the reality of suffering. You have to balance. That's why, as I've said, in most Zen temples, there's Buddha, Manjushri on one side, cutting through with the wisdom, and Avalokiteshvara on the other side. A Buddha balances both. Is one way to look at it in our practice. But that's a very important question because, you know, like one of the Lojong slogans says, do good, avoid evil, you know, appreciate your lunacy and pray for help. That's one of the slogans, you know. So it says, do good and avoid evil. The Dhammapada says, do good and avoid evil. The precepts say, do good, avoid evil. But on a higher level, you're seeing the integration. You're not. There's no duality, and that's why it's so hard for us because we operate in a dualistic world, and this is trying to take you to a place where in your meditation practice, before where you would divide things out into these are good states of mind, these are not good states of mind. In that place where your mind is just kind of calm and peaceful, at peace. You know, it may change the next minute, but in that place, you have an experiential experience of this integration, of what this state of mind that the Heart Sutra is trying to present to you. So maybe I could go through, this is kind of interesting. So this is the 12-fold chain of codependent origination. One thing leads to the next, right? Just like in the skandhas, the eye makes contact, and then you like, dislike, or you don't like results. So what happens here is, and this is kind of interesting, there you can't really see it, but inside are greed, hate, and delusion, which turns the wheel of causation. And you should look at this more as poetry. I mean, some people take this very literally. You know, they, like each one of these divisions, they take very, and they practice it. You know, which, you know, what state is here. I think that you should, it would be helpful to look at this, at least I do. Because if I look at this really in detail, you know, I just, it's too complicated. And I think that's what the Heart Sutra is trying to say. Yeah, this is helpful provisionally, but don't get bogged down in these specifics. Like, in one of the 12-fold chain, there's 12. In another one, there's 10. In this one, I think there's 12. So I'm going to read it to you because this represents, this is supposed to represent when Buddha became enlightened. These were the stages that he went through of realization. And you can either go through it clockwise or you can go through it counterclockwise. So the first two, when there's 12, it's more, I find, from the Tibetan tradition where before you're born, before you're like, you're in the undifferentiated. And then you begin to differentiate down. More and more you differentiate down until you come into a human form. The ones that only have 10 panels are more for people probably like myself that just say, well, let's just take it here. Forget about whether anything's happening on the other side of death. How about just right here? Let's take causality right here. How does it happen right now? How do I create karma? How does karma happen? How does this wheel keep turning? And what we want to do in early Buddhism was to get off the wheel. That's actually what nirvana was sort of getting off the wheel of greed, hate, and delusion. So, but I thought I'd just read these to you. It's kind of interesting because the next time you see this, which you run into, you've all seen this, right? Almost. So here's what it means in the 12th panel. The first one is there's the undifferentiated. You'd say the absolute. Nothing has a conscious form yet. So there's ignorance, misapprehension, just the hint of fixedness, hint of separation and independence. In other words, there's some consciousness beginning to start to differentiate between me and you, or I'm different than the absolute. Then karmic formations start to come in. This is helpful if you study Tibetan Buddhism, like the Tibetan Buddhist Book of Death, where you're in this bardo state, and then karmic things start to turn, and then you actually look down to see what your next incarnation is. I mean, that's in the kind of shamanistic Tibetan tradition. So then these karmic formations start to happen. These stirrings begin to form. And then the third panel, now you're starting to come out of just, you know, the ethereal. Consciousness begins to arise, as now there is a sense of separation. You can't have consciousness without sense of separation. So no abstract consciousness yet, just we have sort of an object to be conscious of. Something is stirring. And then this begins to solidify more and more. So you could say even in our own consciousness, as I was saying, thoughts go by, but then something triggers you and it begins to take more of a form of suffering. So this is a little bit of what's happening right now. You begin to more concretize what your consciousness is. Then you come more into a sense of form. You could say this is a kind of birth. So then we, from 6 through about 9, this is what happens with your, it goes through all these different realms, the realms of the hungry ghosts, the realms of people burning and they're suffering. 6 to 9 means that you're continuing to turn this wheel of greed, hate, and delusion, and you exist in these different realms of suffering. And then, like in number 10, you cling. And you try to push away, you either cling or you try to push away. And then finally, you go through all this, so you could go down here and you can see, depicted as like the hungry ghosts, you know, with big bloated bellies and people burning in fires. And usually in some of these, there'll be, like, here's a bodhisattva up here, and usually there'll be a Buddha, which means that the bodhisattvas are in the hell realms. You don't, I mean, that's where bodhisattvas go, it's where they're suffering, right? So you'll often find down in the hell realms, greed, hate, and delusion realms, there'll be bodhisattvas helping people to try to liberate them from this wheel of karma. And then number 11 and number 12, number 11 and 12 represent birth and death. Birth and death. To be honest with you, I don't know what the distinction is between number 11, that birth, and number 5 down here, which is a different kind of birth. If I figure out the answer to that, I'll get back to you on that. But the idea that you're getting a sick or a representation about how suffering happens and how the wheel of causation happens. So when they... Say that again. Five is form, yeah. Number 4, name and form, we now, and then number 5, it actually comes into form. 5 and 6. I haven't studied it enough to actually tell you what the difference really is between 4, 5, and 6. To me, it just means you're more concretizing what form really is, coming into actually a body from just consciousness. So there's ways you can, you know, this is helpful to hang on your wall and realize that we're, you know, this is one way, visual way to depict how this has actually happened. But what the Heart Sutra is saying is that there, try to find the line here. There is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance. So here's ignorance over here, number 1. You know, ignorance is starting to move you into the realm of form, and no extinction of it, birth. So they jump from number 1 to 12 in just those two words. They're trying to say, no, you know, even these views and ideas of birth and death, it's more a sense of continuum. It's more a sense of what is in flux. So how does this help you in your meditation? Well, it's back to Seicho, and then we'll lead to him. It's more what it helps you in your meditation now, instead of being so specific that you're going to root out some problem, it's more a sense of lightness in how you approach your spiritual practice. More a sense of flexibility. More a sense of love. Not having to push anything out, but more a sense of acceptance. That's what this Heart Sutra is trying to move you into. And, you know, it's being chanted right now, you know, in a number of monasteries that I've said, in China, Korea, Tibet, and Japan. So it's a very, it's probably the most important sutra that's nice and short, and, you know, you can just do the last line, gate, gate, para gate. Parsam gati bodhi svaha. So, today, and,